Community. The BBC's big concert, tomorrow from 11:30, here on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3 is on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Ian Skelly.
The Prime Minister will try to defuse the tension over the Gulf of Mexico oil spill when he speaks to President Obama this afternoon. Downing Street has said the conversation will be statesmanlike and workmanlike. David Cameron is under pressure to defend BP in the face of sharp criticism from the White House. Some British business people have partly blamed what they perceive to be the President's anti-British tone for the slump in BP's share price. The interim government in Kyrgyzstan has asked Russia to send peacekeeping troops to help end violence in the southern city of Osh. At least 60 people have been killed and more than 600 have been injured in clashes between Kyrgyz and ethnic Uzbeks. It's the worst unrest since the overthrow of President Kurmanbek Bakayev in April. Opposition leaders in Iran have called off protests to mark the first anniversary of President Ahmadinejad's disputed re-election. They said they didn't want to be responsible for the loss of innocent life. New proposals have been put forward to try to end the long-running dispute between British Airways and the Unite Union. BA cabin crew have taken 22 days of strike action since March over planned changes to staffing, pay and conditions. No details of the proposals have been made public. The Queen has been celebrating her official birthday with the trooping of the colour parade at Buckingham Palace. Hundreds of soldiers who returned from Afghanistan just 2 months ago have been taking part in the annual display. And people from many walks of life have been recognised in the Queen's birthday honours. From the music world, the composer George Benjamin becomes a CBE. They also range from a railway station announcer, appointed an MBE, to the actress Catherine Zeta-Jones, who becomes a CBE for services to the film industry and charity. She said she was absolutely thrilled. And the weather, it'll be a dry afternoon with most places having some sunshine. In northern Scotland, though, it'll stay fairly cloudy with occasional light rain. Overnight, rain will spread into Scotland and Northern Ireland, as well as Northern England and Wales. Elsewhere, it should stay dry, but will become increasingly cloudy. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2:30 past one.
And now today's early music show. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. I guess most of us would agree that to be successful in whatever field, you need talent and dedication. But it's also helpful to behave decently and be, well, generally a reliable sort. Today's composer, Henri Desmarais, had the first two attributes in droves. Quite early on, his skill and appetite for hard work opened doors to the sort of wealthy, even royal, patrons that every composer in late 17th century France needed to pursue a good career. Unfortunately, though, he had an unstable and impulsive character that seriously affected his life. In short, he was his own worst enemy, and his career, which at first seemed so promising, came to dramatic ruin thanks to two far-fetched adventures, one of which saw him fleeing for his very life. Consequently, Henri Desmarais has languished for many years in the shadows of musical history, a minor figure sandwiched between those two French giants, Lully and Rameau. But recently, he's undergone something of a rehabilitation. Scholars have looked at him more closely and discovered a man of great talent, in fact, one of the supreme masters of his age, whose music has been ignored for far too long. And like all the best early musicians, Desmarais began his career in the church. How long wilt thou hide thy face from me, O Lord? Les Arts Florissants, with the first part of Usqueque Domine by Henri Desmarais. And the feeling of distress and anguish in that grande motet, both the words and the music, is especially poignant, considering what state of mind Desmarais must have been in as he wrote it, living as he was in forced exile. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to his beginnings. Born in Paris in 1661, Henri Desmarais spent his childhood as a chorister in Louis XIV's Chapel Royal, where he got a thorough grounding in music. He studied polychoral composition, how to set a line of plain song, and how to sing in the so-called Italian style. He even got the chance to take part in some of the first operas written by Lully, a man who would later be a major influence. At 19, Desmarais had begun to show great promise as a composer, and on leaving the choir, Louis XIV took him on as a court musician. When a search was on for new directors for the chapel, Desmarais naturally put himself forward. Each candidate had to compose a grand motet, and although Desmarais' piece was considered accomplished, he was felt to be too young and inexperienced. It was, however, around this time that the first of the dramas of his life occurred. As it happened, one of the successful applicants for the new chapel directors, a man called Nicolas Goupier, lacked confidence in his own abilities, and he had the sneaky idea of paying Desmarais secretly to write some grand motets for him. He would pass them off as his own work, in fact publish them under his own name. It was an ongoing arrangement that suited them both. Goupier would get the glory, and Desmarais would get regular dosh. And it went on, would you believe, for 10 whole years, until, for some reason, Goupier suddenly stopped paying. Desmarais blew the whistle, and the whole deception was exposed. So let's hear part of one of these grand motets now. No wonder Goupier was keen to cash in on his erstwhile friend's skills. It's a wonderfully fresh and expansive sound, elegant, majestic music that must have been thrilling as it reverberated around Louis's newly built chapel at Versailles. And we have a splendid performance for you as well, from the singers and instrumentalists of Le Concert Spirituel, directed by Hervé Niquet.
Thank you.
The first part of her setting of Psalm 129, De Profundis, by Henri Desmarais, written for Louis XIV in the 1680s. Well, with Goupillot dismissed as a fraudster, Desmarais was pretty optimistic about stepping into his shoes. After all, he'd been ghostwriting motets for him for a whole decade. The king, however, was not amused by the trick, and again the job went to another. Still, at least Desmarais was now able to write music openly under his own name, and he began to gravitate more and more towards secular forms of composition. Unfortunately, his plan to study in Italy was thwarted by the powerful Lully, royal music's top dog, who made it his business to keep any competition safely out of the way. But there were opportunities for up-and-coming talents, and Desmarais' very first opera, Endymion, was given over several days in the king's apartments, and it was much admired. But getting his theatrical works performed at the prestigious Académie was another matter. Founded in 1669 as the Académie d'Opéra, and originally housed in a converted tennis court, this was a company authorised by the king and charged with making opera better known to the general public all over France. By the early 1670s, Lully had taken charge of it, and with some chutzpah, ruled that his own works only could be performed there. After his death, though, the next generation of composers were finally able to get their operas performed as well, including Desmarais, whose first tragédie en lyrique, Didon, based on the Dido myth, was a great success. And yet, even after Lully, the theatre world was still fraught with backbiting. Desmarais was accused of copying Lully's music, and his next two stage works made very little impression. Then, a few months later, Desmarais had already begun work on the music for a new opera by one of the court noblemen when a quarrel broke out with a fierce devotee of Lully, who thought that he should be composing the music for it. It all got rather nasty, and Desmarais was forced to abandon the opera, and it was eventually completed some years later by André Compre. Around that same time, though, Desmarais was also writing another opera, and this one he did complete. It's that great love story from Ovid, Venus and Adonis. Here's some of the wonderfully energetic dance music from it, performed by the instrumentalists of Les Talents Lyriques, directed by Christophe Rousset. Thank you. Les Talons Lyriques with a selection of dances from Henri Desmarais' Venus and Adonis, given at the Paris Opera in the mid-1690s. So by the time he was in his 30s, Henri Desmarais had already had his fair share of bad luck. Now, though, he found himself embroiled in a major scandal that would have much more serious consequences for the rest of his life. Within months of the death of his first wife, Desmarais fell deeply in love again, this time with one of his pupils, Marie-Marguerite de Saint-Gobert. The good news was that she was a nubile 18-year-old. The bad news was that she was the daughter of the distinguished president of the Electorate of Senlis, whose plans for his eligible offspring certainly did not involve a mere court musician. The couple's lurid story had all the ingredients of romantic fiction: love, lust, parental opposition and elopement, in a cloak-and-dagger affair that yielded everything from banishment to a convent to a long legal trial. Desmarais, under pain of death, escaped to Brussels with his teenage mademoiselle, and so began his long exile from France. Luckily, he still had a few allies left, and one of his old friends from the Chapel Royal now came to the rescue in the form of a letter of recommendation to the King of Spain, Philip V. This did the trick, and within 2 years, Desmarais was appointed maître de musique de la chambre at the royal court in Madrid. We're going to hear now part of one of the grandest pieces Desmarais wrote for the church, a mass for two choirs and two orchestras. In fact, very few of these French large-scale works have come down to us today, probably because they tended to be written for specific occasions and were rarely performed more than once. So we must thank the composer André Philidor for preserving this one. He was a loyal friend to Desmarais, even in his darkest days. It's a wonderfully impressive piece. The Agnus Dei that we're going to hear now is, I think, particularly fine. Lamb of God, that takest away the sins of the world, have mercy upon us. choir of the Versailles Centre for Baroque Music with the Agnus Dei from the Mass for two choirs and two orchestras by Henri Desmarais. You're listening to The Early Music Show here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. And today we're exploring the life and music of the French composer Henri Desmarais. So we left Desmarais in exile, first in Brussels and then from 1701 in Spain at the royal court. Here he was in charge of 12 singers and instrumentalists whose duties were to perform for the pleasure of the king and queen, operas and small-scale theatre pieces. It could have been a dream job, but sadly, yet again, things were not going to run smoothly. The trouble was, at this time, Spain was in the middle of the War of the Spanish Succession, and after just 2 years, Philip V, with no doubt more serious matters on his mind, dismissed his musicians. Not that Desmarais could return home to France even now, of course. He still had a death sentence on him, don't forget, not to mention his wife's still-fuming family. So once again, out of a job and very likely penniless, Desmarais had finally hit rock bottom. Help came 3 years later when he was offered the appointment of Surintendant de la Musique by Duke Leopold I at the court of Lorraine in the northeast corner of France. Without so much as a second thought, he accepted, packed up his bags and his family, and in the spring of 1707, he arrived in his new home. The Duke was a cultured sort. Like so many monarchs all over Europe and beyond, he modelled his court on that of Louis XIV, employing the greatest architects, dancers and musicians that he could find, and he was delighted to offer Desmarais the job of providing music for worship, for festivals and entertainments. And yet, however good life was in Lorraine, part of Desmarais, well, a large part really, longed to return home. Various friends and protectors tried in vain to get Louis XIV to pardon him, and eventually, after the king's death, the conviction was finally quashed. Now free to return, and with an eye on the post of sous-maître at the royal chapel, no less, Desmarais composed a new opera. Once again, he was unsuccessful, though, and when his wife died the following year, he finally gave up all hope of returning home, resigned to his fate. Let's hear part of one of the church motets he wrote in Lorraine, a setting of Psalm 145, Praise the Lord, O Jerusalem.
Thank you.
Music from Lauda Jerusalem, a grand motet by the exiled French composer Henri Desmarais. Well, realising now that he'd never be able to return home, Desmarais began to decline. He lost his inspiration, hardly wrote any new works, and on the accession of the new Duke of Lorraine, he was dismissed from court altogether. He was now 76 years old, and less than 4 years later, he died. So was all this bad luck of his own making? Who can say? But perhaps the hardships he suffered all through his life intensified his leaning towards emotional, anguished music. From the moment he'd emerged from the chapel choir, such a youthful, promising talent, Desmarais seemed to put all his faith, all his soul into composing. So let's end the programme today with the final sections of the piece that many people consider to be his masterpiece. His Te Deum de Paris, performed here by Le Concert Spirituel, directed by Hervé Niquet.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ave Nike, conducted Le Concert Spirituel in that recording of the final part of Henri Desmarais' Te Deum de Paris. And it ends today's early music show, which was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Manchester by Sam Phillips. Well, there's no edition of the early music show tomorrow. The next one will be next Saturday, when Catherine Bott will be looking at the last surviving opera by Scarlatti, Griselda. That's just after the 1 o'clock news, next Saturday lunchtime, here on BBC Radio 3.
The Tokaj Quartet returns to Performance on 3 on Tuesday and Wednesday for the final concerts of their acclaimed Beethoven cycle. Tuesday's programme leaps from the buoyant good humour of Opus 18 to the intense sublimity of Opus 135. And on Wednesday evening, a chance to hear the monumental fugue of Opus 130, a towering achievement so unprecedented that Beethoven thought it best to hide in the local tavern during its premiere. The Tokaj Quartet conclude their Beethoven cycle in Tuesday and Wednesday's Performance on 3 at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now another chance to hear last Monday's live Wigmore Hall concert. The presenter is Sean Rafferty.
A very good afternoon and welcome to Wigmore Hall for a recital by, well, one of the most outstanding and wide-ranging of the young generation of pianists. Stephen Osborne has achieved brilliance by the deep insight and quiet intensity of his playing. His recording of the Varega by Messiaen as enthusiastically received as his dazzling account of music by Chopin's eccentric compatriot Charles Valentin Alkan. His recording of Rachmaninoff's 24 Preludes was editor's choice in just about all the music magazines, BBC, Gramophone, International Record Review, and we will hear him play Rachmaninoff later. But the main part of his recital here at Wigmore Hall is Beethoven, and very varied at that. The 11 Bagatelles, Opus 119, the Fantasia in G minor, Opus 77, and the work that begins today's programme, the Piano Sonata No. 25 in G, Opus 79. It comes from the very fruitful year of 1809, when he penned three closely related sonatas, the Fifth Piano Concerto and the Quartet Opus 74. This short sonata we're to hear, Beethoven suggested should really be called a sonatina or a sonata facile. Maybe the last two movements could conceivably be thus described, but the opening movement is a full-blooded animal, full of changing dynamics. It's marked Presca alla Tedesca in the German style, the dancing rhythm coming right at the end. There's a rolling barcarolle and Dante, and the final short movement is Vivace. So to play the sonata for piano in G major of the 79 here at Wigmore Hall, Stephen Osborne.